Due to the lack of BSG news, I am going to be changing up this show a little bit, and I'll be playing you a series of X-1. This was playing in the late 1950s, and they were a series of very good science fiction stories, usually with a twist at the end. This first one is A Hail of Air, and I've always wanted to write a fanfic at the end of this, and you'll probably see why. It is very open-ended. It's a very intriguing concept, especially the idea of claustrophobia and thinking you're the only one left when you're not, but still keeping going, keeping the tradition. There's a lot of questions that are raised. Is it really worth teaching others traditions if it doesn't seem like there's any point to it and the world is different? But in this case, I think it comes out that it was important. There always is hope, so it's a very interesting concept. It's based on, of course, an original story that appeared in a magazine.
In just a moment, X-1. But first, if you're planning to join the family for this holiday weekend, remember you have a friend who will keep you company through the long hours on the road. That friend is your car radio, and it brings you a full weekend of the most stimulating variety entertainment when you tune in to NBC's Monitor. Yes, you set your dial just once for hours and hours of refreshing variety. News as it happens, sports coverage, everything from baseball to skin diving, interviews with the stars, plus lots of the relaxing music you like to hear. It's all on Monitor this weekend. And now stay tuned for X-1 on NBC.
Countdown for blast off. X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
Tonight's story, A Pail of Air, by Fritz Leiber.
It was pretty quiet in the nest. Pa was just sitting by the fire, staring into it like he does these days. And Ma was asleep. That's why it was so quiet. Ma has some pretty bad times when she just screams and screams and huddles back against the blankets that line the nest. Sis was looking at herself in the mirror that hangs next to the bookshelf. I don't know what she finds to look at so long, but then she's a girl. She just looks at herself. Saturdays, when Pa puts a couple of extra lumps of coal on the fire and we take a bath, she looks at herself in the mirror and sometimes she cries. I dropped the book I was reading, and I guess that woke Ma.
Huh? What? Ma?
Pick up the book, Bud.
I'm sorry, Pa.
It's come back. Hasn't it, Alfred? It's come back.
It was just Bud. He dropped his book.
Oh, but it's come back. Well, it's out there now, isn't it? I feel a lot warmer.
Now, Ethel.
It's up there in the sky. Just the way it always was. I know. I had a dream, Alfred.
I know, dear. Sis, melt your mother a cup of water.
I'm combing my hair.
Sis.
Oh, all right.
I've got to get up. I know it's there. There'll be crocuses, and the spring bulbs, and daffodils.
What are daffodils, Ma?
Well, Buddy, they're a flower, and they're very pretty. Yellow, on a tall green stalk. Oh, I want to go out. I want to take the children out.
All right now, Ethel. Here's some water.
Come on, children. We'll all go out, and you can play in the sun.
Sure, Ma.
Here, drink the water, Ma.
It's cold, Alfred. You wrap on the pipes and make that super send up some more heat.
What's a super, Pa?
It doesn't matter, Bud. There aren't any anymore.
Oh.
Pa, the pail's running low.
Bud, you better get into your things and go out and get an extra pail of air.
There are a couple of pails behind the first blankets.
Go on, get into your things.
It isn't back, is it?
No, it isn't.
There's no sun in the sky. No sun, is there?
No, Ma. What was it like?
The sun.
Sis, don't get your Ma upset.
The sun was yellow. And so bright you couldn't look at it. Burning hot. So hot. But when you stretched out in it, made you feel warm all over. Tingly warm. It's been so long since I've been that warm.
I was warm last year on my birthday when Pa put all that extra coal on.
And then every morning it would come out of the east. Make the clouds all pink and yellow. The mist would rise in the ground, and then slowly everything would glow warmer, warmer. And then it would be up there in the sky, shining, warm.
Hurry up, Bud.
I'm almost ready, Pa.
I want the sun. I want the sun back. Alfred, get me the sun.
It's gone, Ethel. Nothing I can do.
For Christmas? On my birthday?
Go ahead, Bud. Take the big pail and get it full this time. There's no sense in taking the trip for only half a bucket of air.
Oh, I spilled it the last time.
It's dark, Alfred, it's dark!
Go ahead, Bud.
Strap down the helmet, will you, sis?
For goodness sake, stand up straight.
Okay. All right, I'll be right back.
Don't hold the blankets open too long. All right, Ethel. We're all safe. Bud will be right back with another pail of air. It's all right.
I went through the 30 or so blankets that Pa hung up to slow down the air escaping from the nest. Of course, I knew the way. I've been going out for air since I was a kid. Still, I get a funny, crawly feeling every time I go out of the nest. You gotta go up to the fifth floor, which is just above the blanket of frozen air. You see, when the earth got cold, all the water in the air froze first and made a blanket about 10 feet thick or so. And then down on top of that dropped all the crystals of frozen air, making another blanket 60 or 70 feet thick. I came out of the window we use on the fifth floor and started to scoop up the air into my pail. I had it about full. Boy, my fingers were getting pretty cold when I saw something. Hey, that's a light. Oh, darn it, I kicked over the bucket. Oh, there can't be a light. Not moving around in a window like that. There can't be. Ma and Pa and Sis are back in the nest. I'm up here, and there can't be anyone else. Everybody on Earth is dead except us. I had an idea how Ma must feel sometimes, the way she sees things. But there it was, moving around in the building across the way. I stood there shaking, and I almost froze my feet. I did frost my helmet so solid on the inside I couldn't see anything. So I hurried up and scooped up another bucket of air and headed back for the nest as fast as I could. Pa! Pa, I saw something.
Go on, hang those outside clothes up by the fire.
Phew. Pa, I saw something. I did.
Shh. Your mother's quiet now. Don't upset her.
Pa, it was a light.
Wait till I get this air next to the fire. Give me the cloth, sis.
Shall I put another lump of coal on, Pa?
No. The oxygen from this bucket will get the fire up when it begins to melt. There.
Pa, I'm trying to tell you, I saw something up there. Light.
There's lots of lights. Stars.
I know what stars look like, Dopey. They're big, steady white lights in the sky. This was down here in a building.
What is it? Alfred, what is it?
Nothing, Ethel. No, what is this, Bud?
Well, first I thought it was a lady, a young lady. I mean it. Like in one of those old magazines. I thought I saw it in a window. But then all I saw was a light.
You watched it for some time, son?
Long enough for it to pass five windows and go to the next floor.
And it didn't look like stray electricity?
No, Pa, I know what that looks like.
Or a star refracted through an icicle? Sometimes if you catch it at the right angle, it...
Pa, honest, I never saw anything like it before.
All right. I'll go out with you and you show me.
No, no, Alfred. You can't go and leave us alone, not both of you.
It's all right. We'll be right back.
Here's your helmet, Pa.
There's something out there. I've always known there was something out there waiting to get us.
Hand me my glove.
Something that's part of the cold, hates all warmth, wants to destroy the nest. It's been watching us all this time. Now it's coming after us, and it'll get you, and then it'll come for me. Oh, don't go. Alfred, please don't go.
Everything will be all right. Now, sis.
Yes, Pa?
You come watch the fire. Keep an eye on that air, too. If it gets too low or doesn't seem to be boiling fast enough, get another bucket behind the blanket.
Alfred, don't go.
I'll take care of it, Pa. Could there really be anybody out there?
I don't see how. We heard the last radio voices a year before Bud was born. There hasn't been anything since then.
Then what could it be?
I don't know. Probably just a reflection. An ice crystal cracking. Come on, Bud. Get your helmet on.
It's funny. When I go out alone, I'm not scared or anything. But when I go out with Pa, I always hang onto his belt like I used to when I was a little kid. Habit, I guess. It's the same no matter what trip we take. On the fifth floor, we stopped to rest just before we went out. We were in the room with the frozen people. The lady sitting looking at the door. The man holding his hands over that funny metal thing Pa calls a radiator. It was like a fire, I guess, but I don't see any place for the cold. We put our helmets together so we could talk.
Catch your breath, son.
Pa, would it be possible... I mean, for any of the frozen people to come to life? Like the ones down in the basement around the furnace when we go for water?
No, they're dead. They were caught too quickly when it happened.
Oh, Pa, how do we know we're the only ones?
We don't, but... Well, there's a feeling you get. Because it's always night. There used to be some of that feeling every night in the old days. But the sun chased it away every morning. You wouldn't know about that. You weren't born when the dark star pulled us away from the sun. You wouldn't know unless you'd seen the sun...
I've seen the sun. It's that big star at the end of the Big Dipper. I've seen it.
It isn't the same. Come on. We're wasting time.
I don't know what the city looked like in the old days, but now it's beautiful. The starlight lets you see it pretty well. We're up on a hill, and the plain slopes down away from us. Some taller buildings push up out of the feathery plain, topped by rounded caps of air crystals. Some of them are on a slant because a lot of the buildings were badly twisted by the quakes and everything when a dark star pulled the earth away from the sun. That's why Pa can't seal up the nest airtight. The building's twisted too bad. Besides, we have to keep the chimney open. We touched our helmets together so we could talk.
Is that where you saw it, son?
It isn't there anymore.
Uh-huh.
It feels different. I mean, as if there's something out here, waiting.
Bud, if you see something like that again, don't tell the others.
Huh? Why not?
Well, your ma's sort of nervous these days, and we owe her all the feeling of safety we can give her. Once it was when your sister was born, I was ready to give up and die, but your mother kept me trying. Another time, she kept the fire going a whole week all by herself when I was sick.
She couldn't do that now. Not the way she is.
But you know that game we sometimes play, tossing a ball around? Well, courage is like a ball. A person can hold it only so long, and then he's got to toss it to someone else. When it's tossed your way, you've got to catch it and hold it tight. And hope there'll be someone else to toss it to when you get tired of being brave.
Yeah, I guess so.
Come on. We'll fill up the pails and get back.
But what about whatever it is out here.
We'll just have to wait and see. Come on. Before the helmets frost over.
It's pretty hard to hide your feelings in the nest. I mean, there's just room for the four of us. The blanket overhead just touches when Pa stands up straight. The floor is all covered with thick woolly rugs. Pa says it's inside a much bigger room, but I've never seen the real walls or ceiling. Well, anyway, Pa laughed and kidded about what I'd seen. He said I had an imagination, but we could tell he took it serious. It was Sunday morning by the clocks that Pa kept all wound up on the shelf. So it was time for the story. We all sat around in a circle the way we always do. Except I noticed that Pa casually took a hammer from the shelf and put it beside him. I always liked the story. Of course, Sis and I know it by heart, but now... I mean, every Sunday since we were kids. But every once in a while, Pa surprises us by telling it a little different. Or throwing in some extras. It starts out with a song. Ma used to sing it, but she forgets the words sometimes. And now Pa sings it mostly.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, thy purple mountain majesties above the fruited plain.
Of course, the words don't mean anything. I mean, the skies are spacious enough, but there aren't any waves of grain. And the plain is all covered with a blanket of frozen air. But it's part of the story ceremony, and Pa likes it. He says it reminds him of the old days. After the song, Pa starts the story.
In the days of my youth, the sun hung above, golden and warm, and the earth was fruitful and multiplied, and the fields were green, and the day was glorious. The wind blew across the hilltops, and air was free and good to breathe.
That's the part of the story I like best, about how it was with the sun nice and warm. It's hard to believe all those people living without having to worry about cold and air. They were waking up sweating and screaming because you dreamed the fire went out. It's impossible to believe, but Pa was a good storyteller, and he made it seem real.
And then the dark star came rushing out of space. In the beginning, they tried to keep the news from the people, but when the floods and the earthquake started, the truth came out. At first, they thought the dark star would hit the sun, and then they were afraid it would strike the earth itself. But it didn't. It only came close.
Pa tells it like the sun and the dark star fought for the earth like two dogs over a bone. I know what he means because I've seen a picture of a dog in a magazine. And then the dark star won and carried us off. But the sun kept the moon. There were earthquakes and floods. Pa says that mountains fell and oceans slopped over. Oceans, that's a lot of melted water lying around loose. It's hard to imagine. Pa says it was so. Then came the open question time in the story. Sis asked a question about what girls wore for clothes. And I asked Pa how people acted in those days when the earth was twisted and jerked almost apart.
Well, Bud, I was too busy to notice much. A friend of mine, Dr. Weisbrot, and Kelly, the geophysicist, and Walters, the astronomer, we knew what was going to happen. And we were working to fix up a place with airtight walls and insulation and big supplies of food and bottled air. But the place got smashed up in the earthquakes and... they were all killed. So I put the nest together at the last minute in the living room of our apartment. It's a four-room apartment.
You must have seen some of the people, like the frozen ones downstairs.
At that time, Bud, I only thought of one thing. Your mother and survival. If I had stopped to think, I wouldn't have even tried to make the nest. It would have seemed ridiculous. Blankets and a coal fire against the cold and vacuum of space. But I didn't think.
I survived.
I wasn't listening carefully as Pa went on about the building of the nest. I kept thinking about something else. About that light I'd seen outside. I kept asking myself, what if the frozen people were coming to life? What if they were like the liquid helium that crawls toward heat when it should be frozen solid? What if something were coming from the dark star to get us? Something making the frozen people move, not by themselves. That would fit with what I'd seen. A young lady's face and the moving light. I sat there and shivered, thinking of the frozen people with minds from the dark star creeping, crawling, snuffing their way, following the heat to the nest. And then, over from beyond the blankets, I thought I heard a tiny noise.
So I asked myself then, what's the use of going on? Why prolong a doomed existence of hard work and cold and loneliness? The human race is done. The earth is done. Why not give up, I asked myself.
And then I did hear the noise, louder this time. A kind of shuffling tread coming closer.
And then I got the answer. The Earth's always been a lonely place millions of miles from the next planet. And no matter how long the human race might have lived, the end would have come some night. Those things don't matter. What matters is that life is good. There's a lovely texture, like some rich cloth of fur or the petals of flowers. Crocuses, daffodils, or the fire's glow. And that's as true for the last man as the first.
Still, those steps kept shuffling closer. Pa was talking, and Ma was dreaming with her eyes closed, and Sis was looking at herself sideways in the mirror. And I was the only one who heard the noise. A noise outside.
So right then and there, I told myself that I was going on as if we had all eternity ahead of us. I'd have children, and I'd teach them all I could. I'd get them to read books, try to enlarge and seal the nest. I'd try to keep everything beautiful and alive. I'd keep alive my feeling of wonder, even at the cold and the dark and the distant stars.
Pa, shh. Pa, I hear.
I know.
What is it, Alfred? What is it? What's going on? Oh, you've got to tell me.
Pa, I'm scared.
Quiet. Bud, you heard it?
Uh-huh. A kind of shuffling, coming toward the nest.
Oh.
Sis, take care of your mother.
It's all right, Ma. Lie down. Come on.
I'll take the hammer. You take the hatchet.
What is it, Pa? What is it?
I don't know. Listen.
It's closer.
Oh, mush.
Pa, the blanket is moving.
Ready with your axe.
Hello.
Ah!
Who's there? Is there somebody in there?
Come in. It's all right.
They're alive. Alive.
Who are you?
Alfred. Alfred. Hutchinson. Dr. Alfred Hutchinson. You can take off your helmets in here.
But the air.
We have air.
We bring it in pails.
Come on, Ralph. Let's take off the helmets.
It's impossible.
Where are you from? We thought we were the only ones.
Los Alamos.
The nuclear laboratory.
Yes, that's right. We get our power from the reactor, using the stockpile of bombs for fuel.
Then there are others. There are other men. There are other men.
Pa, is it all right? Should I put the axe down?
Yes, it's all right. You can put it down.
You mean you come from another nest?
It's a little bigger than this. We've got a small airtight city with airlocks.
We generate our electricity, food from hydroponics.
I can't believe it. I can't.
I can't believe this. It's impossible. You can't maintain an air supply without hermetic sealing. It's impossible.
Oh,
No, it's simple. As long as you keep the fire going to melt the air, and enough air boiling to keep the fire burning.
How did you come here? Why?
Well, we keep scouting around for survivors. There are a number of colonies, Brookhaven, Oak Ridge, and Harwell in England, and the Argonne Laboratory in France. We didn't expect to find anything in this city, though. But our detectors picked up a heat trace, so we tracked it down.
Alfred, you're forgetting your manners. We have company.
Of course. Sis, throw a handful of coal on the fire.
Pa, a whole handful?
Doesn't matter now. And Bud, bring out another pail of air.
Oh, it's incredible.
And you have laboratories and transport?
We only have a 2-seater scout, but if we rip out the bulkhead to the storage compartment, we can make it all right.
We can have you back at Los Alamos in 4 hours.
What's the matter?
I guess we really hadn't thought about it that way.
But, I wouldn't know how to act there. And besides, I haven't any clothes.
Just doesn't seem right to let this fire go out. It's been 18 years. Burning every minute.
But you can't stay here.
Ralph.
But after all...
Ralph.
Oh. Look, Dr. Hutchinson, we'll go out to the ship and bring back a small power heater. I know this is very sudden and upsetting to you. You need a chance to adjust. We'll be back in a few minutes. It's incredible. In buckets, air in buckets.
Well,
they didn't think the nest smelled so good. I could tell.
She had a wave in her hair. Did you see that? And lipstick.
I suppose we have to decide what to do.
Pa, at Los Alamos and those other places, there'll be lots of people, won't there?
Yes.
I mean, not just your father or a brother.
That's right.
Boys?
I suppose so. But somehow I feel a little empty.
Alfred, it's different now that we know others are alive. You don't have to feel the responsibility for keeping the human race going.
Paul, I'd like to see those rockets and laboratories. Wouldn't you, Paul?
I suppose so.
It won't be easy leaving the nest. I mean, it's just right and there's only 4 of us. It's kind of a scary idea. Big place with a lot of strangers.
You'll get over that feeling, son. The trouble with the world was that it kept getting smaller and smaller till it ended with just the nest. Now it'll be good to have a real, huge world again. The way it was in the beginning.
And so, we're gonna leave the nest in the morning. By Pa's clocks. We've got the power heater going now. Seems funny to be this warm when it isn't Christmas or somebody's birthday. But still, it's hard for me to realize that this is the last time I'll go out of the nest, through all the blankets, to get a pail of air.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was an NBC Radio Network production.
This next one, because I still haven't quite gotten my voice back, is Sherlock Holmes, and this was the 1940s. This is The Speckled Band. I will warn you, if you haven't read it, it is on the more frightening side, so don't listen to it if it's at night, unless you've heard the story before. I have left the original advertisements in because, frankly, they're really funny. And the accents in this are quite amusing as well. You might have noticed in the last story, there's a definite sound to radio voices during that time period, which is difficult to emulate now. Although there are some modern radio dramas that are doing it.
This episode from the life of Sherlock Holmes will be transmitted to our men and women overseas by shortwave and through the worldwide facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Petri Wine brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to Dr. Watson tell us another exciting adventure he shared with his old friend, that master detective, Sherlock Holmes. And if you don't mind, I'd like to suggest something that you might share with your friends. And that something is a glass of sherry before dinner. Naturally, a glass of Petri California sherry. I say Petri sherry because it's the perfect before-dinner wine. You couldn't think of a better way to begin a meal. That Petri sherry has a beautiful, inviting color, like dark amber. And for flavor, well, you've heard sherry described many times as having a rich, nut-like flavor. But if you want to learn for the first time what those words, rich and nut-like, really mean, you just taste Petri sherry. It's wonderful. Serve Petri sherry by itself, or serve it with hors d'oeuvres of those little cocktail sandwiches. And incidentally, if you prefer your sherry dry, you know, not sweet, just ask your wine merchant for Petri pale dry sherry. The important thing to remember is, if you want sherry, you want Petri sherry, because that means good sherry. And now let's look in on our genial friend and good host, Dr. Watson. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Bartell. Punctual to the minute as usual.
Never keep a doctor waiting, I always say. Particularly Dr. Watson.
Draw up a chair, my boy.
Thanks.
That's it.
All ready to tell us the Sherlock Holmes adventure of the Speckled Band, Doctor?
Yes, I'm all ready, Mr. Bartell.
Say, Doctor, just what does the Speckled Band mean?
Wait till I've told you the story, young fellow, my lad. You'll find out for yourself.
Sorry. The floor is all yours, Doctor.
The adventure of the Speckled Band began on a rainy April morning in 1883. An urgent call from one of my patients had kept me up most of the night before, and in consequence, I came down to my breakfast rather later than usual, to find that Holmes already left our house some hours earlier. As I sat there reading the morning paper and consuming my two lightly boiled eggs, there was a knock on the door. It opened to disclose a typical example of the British working man, a bag of tools in one hand and a grimy cap in the other. I can hear him now as he spoke to me from the doorway.
You sent for me, Mr. Holmes?
I'm not, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, begging your pardon, Governor. I'm counting in the gas bracket over the mouthpiece.
Huh? What's wrong with it?
I've got a leak in it.
A leak? Well, get along with your work.
Yes, sir. Hope I won't disturb you, sir.
Oh, no, that's all right, my man. Don't mind me.
Very untidy man, Mr. Holmes, sir.
What do you mean by that?
Well, sir, you can't help noticing the mess this room's in. I've heard say he was as tidy as anyone he started, but he learned his habits from a bloke what lived with him. Dr. Watson, I think his name.
You impertinent fellow. How dare you talk like that? I've got a good man. Place before I go. Here, come out of there. That's Mr. Holmes's room.
Don't be angry with me, Watson. I was just slipping out of these grimy rags and into a dressing gown.
Oh, good gracious me. So it was you, Holmes. Upon my soul, I never recognized you. But why the disguise?
Well, a case, my dear fellow, a case. One of those small problems which a trusting public occasionally confides to my investigation. To the British workman, old chap, all doors are open. Yes. His costume is unostentatious and his habits are sociable. Tool bag is an excellent passport. And a tawny moustache will secure the cooperation of the maids.
Oh, but what's the case, Holmes?
Modest little drama of life in the kitchen. One of those seemingly inconsequential affairs. And yet, the honor of a duchess is at stake.
What?
Mad world, my masters, a mad world. Ah! Now I feel a little more comfortable. Let's return to the sitting room, shall we, and a strong cup of tea would be acceptable.
Oh, wish you'd tell me about the Duchess and life in the kitchen.
Another time, old fellow, another time. At the moment, suppose you tell me what you know of Miss Helen Stoner. I received a letter from her this morning in which she informed me that she would be calling here at 11, and also that she was a friend of yours.
Yes, Helen Stoner. Yes, indeed, a charming girl.
Then pour me a cup of tea, Watson, and tell me about her.
Well, I befriended her at the time of the tragic death of her sister 2 years ago. I told you about the case, don't you remember? The sudden death of Violet Stoner at an old house in Stoke Moran?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Huh? It all comes back to me now. There was an inquest, wasn't there? With string of stupid and ineffective witnesses.
What stupid? I was one of them.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Well, then, you were the exception, of course. Wait a minute. Let me see. I docketed the evidence on the case. Where was it? That's scrapful. Oh, yes, here we are. Here we are. Now, let's see. Yes. F. Salisbury, Hatchet Murder, Lordson Simon. Ah, here we are. Stoke Moran. Oh, yes, yes, of course. I remember the affair quite well now. The villain of the piece was Dr. Grimsby Roylott, wasn't he?
Yes, dreadful fellow. He's the stepfather of the two girls. Violet, the one who died so mysteriously, and Helen, the one who's come here to see you.
Dr. Roylott has a pretty record. 55 years of age, killed his hitmaker in India, once in an insane asylum, married money, wife died, distinguished surgeon. I wonder what the distinguished surgeon has been up to now.
Some deviltry, I fear.
Oh, why do you say that?
You remember that Miss Violet Stoner's death followed close upon the announcement of her engagement?
Yes, I do.
Well, I met Miss Helen Stoner in the streets a few weeks ago. She told me that she had just become engaged herself to a young fellow in the army who was leaving for the Far East. She was very upset. The thought of being alone with her stepfather at Stoke Moran.
Well, that's quite natural. You see, Dr. Roylott stands to lose a considerable sum of money in the event of his stepdaughter's marriage.
Yes, they both had a trust fund which he administered only as long as the girls were unmarried. That fact was brought out at the coroner's inquest 2 years ago. But if Roylott did poison the other stepdaughter, and I'm convinced he did, it seems unlikely that he'd try it again. Two sudden deaths in the same household would hardly pass the coroner.
No, my dear Watson, you're making the mistake of putting your normal brain into Roylott's abnormal being.
Oh, that must be Miss Stoner now.
Yes, it's precisely 11 o'clock. Well, let's see what we can do for her.
I hope you can help her, Holmes. She's an extremely nice girl.
Come in. Yes, Mrs. Hudson?
There's a Miss Helen Stoner to see you, sir. Oh. She says she has an appointment.
Show her in, please, Mrs. Hudson.
Aye, sir. Come in, my dear.
Thank you.
Oh, Miss Stoner, I'm so glad to see you again.
Oh, how do you do, Dr. Watson? And this must be your friend.
Yes, Miss Stoner, I am Sherlock Holmes. Sit down by the fire, won't you?
Yes, please sit down, dear. You're trembling with cold.
It's not cold that makes me shiver. Tell me, Mr. Holmes, has my stepfather, Dr. Grimsby Roylott, been here?
No, he hasn't.
He saw me in the street. I dashed by him in a hansom cab, but he saw me. Our eyes met and he waved me to stop, but I came here as fast as I could.
A very sensible move. Dr. Watson has already given me several hints as to your present problem, as well as having refreshed my memory as to the circumstances of your sister's death.
My problem is a simple enough one, Mr. Holmes. I'm waiting to be murdered.
No,
please be a trifle more explicit, Miss Stoner.
Very well, Mr. Holmes. My fiancé is leaving for the Far East today. When he leaves, I shall be alone with my stepfather at Stoke Moran. He plans to murder me just as he murdered my sister.
I bet you say that, Miss Stoner.
Many strange things have happened recently. For instance, he's just moved me into the bedroom in which my sister died.
What reason did he give for changing your room?
That my old one needed repainting. It didn't need it, but Dr. Roylott did need to move me into that horrible room. And other things have happened. I've heard the music again.
Music? What music?
My sister first heard it a few days before she died. I heard it myself on that dreadful night she breathed her last. I was on that terrible...
Don't worry anymore, my dear. Don't worry. You have friends to help you now. Look here, do you mind if I ask you a few questions?
No. Of course not.
Very well, then. Now, this music, does it seem to come from inside the house or outside?
Well, it's hard to say. It sounds so faint.
What's it like?
A sort of soft, droning sound.
Like a flute or pipe?
Yes. It reminds me of native music I heard during my childhood in India.
India, eh? Oh.
There's one other thing that puzzles me, Mr. Holmes.
Oh, what's that?
My sister's dying words. As she lay in my arms, she gasped out two words.
What were they?
Band and speckled. You remember that evidence from the inquest, don't you, Dr. Watson?
Yes, I do. I couldn't make head or tail.
Band, speckled, Indian music. Miss Stoner, do you sleep with your door and windows fastened?
Yes, Mr. Holmes, but so did poor Violet. It didn't save her, though.
What did you gather from your sister's dying allusion to a band? A speckled band?
Well, Sometimes I thought it was merely the wild talk of delirium, and sometimes that it referred to a band of people.
Oh, yes.
I remember that there were some gypsies encamped quite near us at the time of Violet's death.
Gypsies, eh?
Yes. It occurred to me that the spotted, gaily colored kerchiefs, which so many of them wear over their heads, might have suggested the unusual adjectives which my sister used.
Stella, how long is it since you heard this strange music that you've told us about?
I heard it last night.
Last night? Your fiancé leaves today, you say?
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
Well, Miss Turner, I shall do everything I can to help you. If we were to come down to Stoke Moran today, would it be possible to see over your rooms without the knowledge of your stepfather?
I think so. He told me this morning that he intended to take a late train home tonight.
Splendid. Watson, up with the timetable, old fellow, and look up the trains to Stoke Moran.
Right, you are, Holmes.
Oh, that's my stepfather. I know it is. Oh, yes. Yes, there he is on the doorstep. Oh, Mr. Holmes, he's followed me. What shall I do if he finds me here?
Don't worry, Miss Turner. Please don't worry. There's a private exit through that room there. Watson will show you the way.
Come along with me, my dear young lady.
And you will come down today, Mr. Holmes?
Certainly, Miss Turner. I'll telegraph you the time of our arrival. Goodbye and courage, my dear.
Goodbye, Mr. Holmes, and thank you.
Come along quickly, Miss Turner.
Come in. Yes, Mrs. Hudson?
A gentleman, sir. I told him he wouldn't see anyone without an appointment.
Out of the way, woman.
Don't you push me like that. I'm sorry, Mr.
That's Holmes. All right, Mrs. Hudson. You can lead us.
What kind of gentleman does he call himself, pushing an old woman?
So you're Sherlock Holmes.
You have the advantage of me, sir. Your name is...
My name, sir, is Roylott. Dr. Grimsby Roylott of Stoke Moran.
Oh, yes, of course, indeed. Charming place, I hear, and obviously good for the lunch.
You won't trifle with me if you know what's good for you.
Ah, Watson, there you are. How was the experiment?
Very successful, Holmes. Good day to you, Dr. Roylott. I haven't seen you since I gave evidence at your stepdaughter's inquest.
Yes, I remember you, Dr. Watson. Now listen to me, you two. My stepdaughter's been here. I faced her. What's she been saying to you?
It's a little cold for the time of year, isn't it?
You answer me.
I hear the crocuses promise well.
You dare to try and put me off, do you? I know you, you scoundrel. You're Holmes the meddler.
Oh, am I?
Holmes the busybody.
I believe that a man should occupy his time.
Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
When you go out, close the door, won't you? There's a draft.
I'll go when I've had my way. Keep your nose out of my affairs, do you hear?
Oh, yes, my hearing is excellent, thank you. And your diction and delivery, most forceful. But time flies, my dear doctor, time flies, and life has its duties as well as its pleasures.
Insolent rascal. Here. See this poker?
Oh, the fire doesn't need poking, thank you, doctor, please. But I should be obliged if you put some more coal on for me.
You laugh at me. You don't know my strength. Look. There. Your poker's bent double. And that's what I'll do to both of you. Don't keep out of my affairs.
Oh, dear. I had a presentiment that he'd slammed the door.
Phew. He's an ugly customer, Holmes.
Literally as well as figuratively. Watson, I'd be much obliged if you'd get your revolver. It may prove to be an excellent argument for the gentleman who twists iron pokers into knots.
The fellow's amazingly strong. Well, look at it.
Well, I don't want to appear flamboyant, but... there we are.
Great. Scott Holmes, you've straightened the poker out again.
Yes, it was utterly useless in its former shape. And now, Watson, that timetable will catch the next fast train for Stoke Moran.
Oh, Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson, I'm so relieved that you've come. But don't you think my stepfather might have followed you down here?
We have to take that chance, Miss Turner. A few hours' delay might mean a difference between your life and death. It's imperative that he examine this bedroom of yours before Dr. Roylott's return.
Anyway, my dear, you mustn't worry any more. We are here in your house, and we're going to take good care that no harm befalls you.
Thank you, Dr. Watson.
So this is the room in which your sister died, is it? Much as I pictured it.
And Dr. Roylott's room adjoins this one, you say, Miss Turner?
Yes, Doctor, on that side. The room which adjoins it on the other side is my regular bedroom.
The one's being so conveniently painted, eh? Yes. Well, let's examine this room. Uh-huh. No trap doors or sliding panels, I suppose.
Sounds solid enough, Holmes.
Yes, I think it is. Mara, what's this? Are you aware that this bed is clamped to the floor, Miss Stoner?
Why, no, Mr. Holmes, I didn't know that.
What an extraordinary thing.
Was the bed in your other room anchored also?
No, I don't think it was.
It's very illuminating. And this bell pull hanging against the wall above your bed.
Oh, that, it doesn't work.
Well, but if you want to ring.
There's another one on the other wall over there.
Then why this one?
I don't know. My stepfather made a number of changes after we came here.
Yes, quite a burst activity, apparently. And it took some strange shapes.
Oh, why are you standing on the bed, Holmes?
I'm curious, old fellow. It may interest you to know that this bell rope is fastened to a brass hook. There's no wire attachment. It's a dummy.
A dummy? But why?
There's a small screen above it. It's a ventilator, I suppose.
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
Yes. A ventilator leading into your stepfather's room. Curious. I notice there's no means of opening the ventilator on this side. It can only be operated from your stepfather's room next door. I wonder if you might mind taking us in there.
Of course, Mr. Holmes. Follow me.
Thank you.
What do you make of it, old Holmes?
There's devil's work afoot, old chap.
Here we are, Mr. Holmes.
Much the same as the other room. A bit bigger, perhaps.
That large set against the wall seems to be an unusual piece of bedroom furniture. What is it, Miss Stoner?
My stepfather's business papers, really.
You've seen inside it, then?
Only once, some years ago. I remember that it was full of documents.
What's this saucer of milk doing on the top of it? Does Dr. Roylott keep a cat?
No, but he does have a cheetah and a baboon as pets. He brought them with him from India.
Well, Holmes, a cheetah is just a big cat.
That's true, my dear fellow, but I doubt if a saucer of milk would go very far in satisfying the appetite of a cheetah. Well, I think I've seen enough. This matter is too serious for hesitation. Your life may depend upon your following my instructions, Miss Stoner.
I'll do anything you say, Mr. Holmes, anything.
Is that the village inn I see through the trees from this window?
Yes, the Queen's Arms.
Your bedroom windows would be visible from there?
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
Very well, then. Watson and I will go there now and obtain accommodation. When your stepfather returns, you must confine yourself to your room on the pretense of a headache. You follow me?
Perfectly.
When Dr. Roylott retires for the night, you must open your bedroom window and put your lamp on the sill as a signal to us at the inn. Then withdraw quietly to your usual bedroom and the one that's being painted. I'm sure that you can manage that for one night.
Of course. But what will you do?
When we get your signal, Dr. Watson and I will come here and spend the night in your dead sister's room. We are going to solve this mystery of the dummy bell pull, the unusual ventilator, and the strange music in the night.
You'll hear the remainder of Dr. Watson's story in just a second, so I'm just going to point out that at any really important dinner, you know, like when diplomats get together, you'll find wine on the table. Because for years it's been a known fact that good wine makes good food taste better. Prove that to yourself tomorrow night by having your dinner together with a glass of Petri wine. If you prefer a red wine for any meat or meat dish, try a Petri California Burgundy. That rich, hearty red Petri Burgundy is really out of this world. Now, if you'd rather have a subtle, intriguing white wine, let's say to go with chicken or fish, then try Petri California Sauterne. But Sauterne or Burgundy, to make sure it's good, make sure it's Petri, won't you? Well, Doctor, it's a rattling good story so far. What happened next? You went to the local inn, I guess, and waited for that lantern to appear in the bedroom window at Dr. Roylott's house?
That's right, Mr. Bartell. We had an early dinner at the Queen's Arms and then retired to our upstairs bedroom and sat side by side, puffing away at our pipes, our eyes straining through the darkness for that telltale lantern to give us the signal that there was dangerous work ahead of us. As we sat there discussing the various aspects of the case, I remember that Holmes was very concerned about my own safety.
Well, Watson, I really have some scruples about taking you with me tonight. Infernally dangerous business.
What about that poor girl alone in the house with that fiend, Roylott?
Well, I can handle the case by myself, old chap.
I'm coming with you, Holmes. You speak of danger. We haven't seen more in those rooms than was visible to me.
No, but possibly I've deduced a little more. I imagine that you saw all that I did.
Well, I saw nothing remarkable except the bell rope, and what purpose that could answer, I confess, is more than I can imagine.
Well, the ventilator, too.
Yes, but I don't think it's such an unusual thing to have an opening between two rooms. So small that a mouse could hardly pass through it.
True, but at least you will admit there is a curious sequence of coincidences. A ventilator is constructed, a bell cord is hung from it, a lady sleeps in a bed directly below the ventilator, a bed that is anchored to the floor. The lady dies.
I can see what you're driving at, Holmes. Look, 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 look. There's a lantern in Miss Turner's window.
That's our signal, all right. Come on, Watson. Our night's vigil begins.
Foul night.
Foul night for a foul business, Watson. Come on. Through these laurel bushes. It's only another 50 yards to the house.
The lantern's still burning away in the bedroom window.
Yes, and all the other lights are out.
Including the one in Dr. Roylott's room. He must have gone to sleep.
To bed, possibly, Watson, but not, I think, to sleep.
Great heavens, Holmes. Look! Look at that frightful creature leaping about in the moonlight. It looks like some hideous child.
That's Dr. Rolliot's pet baboon.
It looks positively human.
Yes. Probably a great deal more so than its master.
Shh.
Little rat's below the window now. This ivy provides the most convenient ladder. I'll go up first. Here, wait a minute.
Come on, careful, careful. I hope the thing is strong enough to hold us both. Oh, we look pretty stupid in our backs in the mud. Give me a hand, Holmes, will you? I can't quite get my leg over this window ledge.
There you are.
Thank you. Oh, my gosh.
Close the shutters.
Exactly the same as it did this afternoon.
The least sound would be fatal to our plans. Keep the lamp covered, so that if the ventilator is open from Dr. Wallach's room, no light will show from in here, you understand? That's it.
Oh, why are you carrying that sticker?
Prepare for a visitor, and I expect before the night is over. A visitor who will herald his entrance with faint music from an Indian pipe.
You mean the music?
Exactly.
Signal?
That's right. A signal to an accomplice who can enter a room with locked doors. An accomplice who kills and leaves no trace.
You mean the...
No more talking, Watson. No more talking. I'll sit on the edge of the bed here. You sit on that chair. We have a revolver ready in case you should need it.
Right, your arms.
Have a lantern ready, too. When I shout now, turn the light. Pull on the top of the bell rope. You understand?
Perfect.
Good. Now we must wait. Perhaps for some time. But don't go to sleep, old fellow. Don't go to sleep. Your very life may depend on it. That there's no more danger for our end of this roof. After that, we can turn the matter over to the local police. Our work is done.
Oh, Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson, I can't tell you how grateful I am that you've brought me back here to Baker Street.
Dear Miss Stoner, it would have been inhuman to leave you in that house of death and horror. We have a spare bedroom, and Mrs. Hudson is a motherly and understanding woman. And I can assure you that Dr. Watson and I will be delighted to have you stay here until you've decided on your future plans.
Yes, of course we will, my dear. As a matter of fact, it's rather refreshing to have a touch of youth about the place.
You're both so kind. I think it's wonderful how you foiled my stepfather's devilish plans.
Yes, wasn't it? A remarkable example of logical deduction.
No, it wasn't, old chap. But first... Your mention of the gypsies, Miss Stoner, and the use of the word band, put me on an entirely wrong scent. However, when we examined the fatal room, I drew the obvious conclusion.
You mean the dummy bell rope, the ventilator, and the movable bed?
That's right, old fellow. It instantly gave rise to the suspicion that the rope was there as a bridge for something coming through the ventilator and traveling on down to the bed. I at once thought of a snake. I saw the saucer of milk on top of the safe. Well, my suspicions crystallized into certainties.
Fiendish plot. Fiendish.
Yes, an extremely clever one.
Exactly.
My stepfather must have trained the snake to return to him when he played the music.
Yes. He put it through the ventilator with his certainty that it would crawl down the rope and land on the bed. It might or might not bite the occupant. Perhaps she might escape every night for a week, but, oh well, sooner or later she must fall a victim.
Thank heaven I came to you, Mr. Holmes.
Amen to that, Miss Stoner.
You know, Holmes, if you hadn't lashed at the snake with your stick, I bet it wouldn't have turned back on its master.
That's true, old chap. That way I'm no doubt indirectly responsible for Dr. Grimsby Roylott's death. But I can't say it's a fact that's likely to weigh too heavily on my conscience.
Well, Doctor, that was quite a fascinating story. You know something? I'm not exactly a coward, but no kidding. My toes really curl when I get mixed up with snakes.
You know, you're not alone in that respect, Mr. Barkell. I must admit that I like to have a revolver and at least 20 feet between me and any snake that wants to cross my path.
Well, if you want a revolver in 20 feet, I'll take a cannon in 20 miles.
Fortunate that you're a wine expert, Mr. Barkell, and not a detective. I'm afraid you wouldn't, shall we say, find detecting much your liking.
We certainly shall say it. And incidentally, I'm not a wine expert, Doctor. All I know about wine is that it either tastes good or it doesn't. And I also know that Petri wine always tastes good. The Petri family sees to that. The name Petri on the label is the personal assurance of the Petri family that every drop of wine in that bottle is good wine. And they know how to make it good because they've been making fine wine for generations. Handing down from father to son, every secret, every skill of the winemaker's art. Yes, the Petri family took time to bring you good wine. That's why no matter what type of wine you wish, you can't go wrong with a Petri wine. Well, Dr. Watson, what new Sherlock Holmes story are you planning to tell us next week?
Well, now, let me see. Next week, Mr. Bartell, next week, I think I'll tell you an adventure that took place at a gambling casino in the south of France. A strange story of sudden tragedy and death. I call it The Adventure of the Double Zero.
Sounds swell. We'll all be listening.
Oh, now, just a minute, Mr. Bartell. Before I go, I want to say that every one of our friends bought war bonds to help our boys win the war. Now let's all buy victory bonds to help bring them back home again. Yes, and let's buy victory bonds to make sure that the men who were wounded will get the finest possible care. Those same victory bonds will help make the GI Bill of Rights a success, too. And they'll help provide for the families of those men who gave everything, including their lives. The men of our armed forces finished their job. Now let's finish ours. Buy victory bonds.
Tonight's Sherlock Holmes adventure is written by Dennis Green and Anthony Boucher and is an adaptation of the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story, The Adventure of the Speckled Band. Music is by Dean Postler. Mr. Rathbone appears through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Mr. Bruce through the courtesy of Universal Pictures, where they are now starring in the Sherlock Holmes series. The Petri Wine Company of San Francisco, California, invite you to tune in again next week, same time, same station. This is Harry Bartell saying goodnight for the Petri family. Sherlock Holmes comes to you from our Hollywood studios. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
So let me know what you think. Stop by AlessandroGiuliani.com, and hopefully I'll have my voice back soon. Until then, I will be bringing you more X-1.